There's really not much left to say about our guest speaker today. All the good lines have already been used. The human headline, which we saw in Simon's column this morning, the mouth from the south. I packed my brain, racked my brain, thinking what unique, different and original words I could say to introduce Darren. But unfortunately, all I could come up with was a well-worn, tried-and-true phrase. Our guest speaker today needs no introduction. Shame, John, shame. Well, the name Darren Hinch arouses passion. We love what he says, we hate what he says, but we always react to what Darren says. And I guess the name Darren Hinch has slipped into our folklore. Darren Hinch is as familiar as meat pies and Holden cars, but I don't think he's on the living treasures list just yet. His story, or his career in the media, really is a story in itself. So too is his life. He has certainly taken us all on a very public roller coaster ride over many years now. Darren's career in the electronic media is well documented by the headline writers. The Hinch television program on 10, host of Midday, the guru of Melbourne radio on 3AW. What's probably not as well known is Darren's distinguished career as a print journalist. I first laid eyes on Darren Hinch while I was a copy boy at the Sydney Sun. And Darren back then, even as a mere callow youth, I think he was only 17, he told me today, he lied about his age to get a job when he arrived in Sydney from New Zealand, was tough, fearless, relentless, fiercely committed to good yarns, but also to the integrity of good journalism. Darren went on to become the representative of Fairfax for the Sydney Sun and the Sydney Morning Herald, based in New York. And his reports on the American race riots all those years ago remain, in my mind, as some of the finest pieces of reporting that I've ever read. And eventually, as editor of the Sydney Sun, only for a brief time, he brought a new vitality to the paper and, interestingly enough, created great loyalty amongst his staff. Now, Darren has brought the roller coaster to Adelaide as host of the 5DN breakfast show. And he told me today he has denied the headline that was given prominence in Melbourne, which said something like, "Why I would never live in Adelaide." I'm pleased to say Darren is finding Adelaide a pleasant experience. So, ladies and gentlemen, may I introduce to you Darren, and maybe soon Senator Darren Hinch.
Hey, John, see, that brought back some memories. I thought I'd died. Get out of the way first. I'm Darren Hinch and you're not. I'll get to the why I won't live in Adelaide story later. It was a great... I know all journalists always say when they're attacked by a subject, they always say to them, look, I didn't write the headline, a sub-editor did. And you always blame the sub-editors. In fact, I was talking to the Premier this morning. He ambushed me in Tint Street, and he said, "You're going to the press club for lunch today?" I said, "Yes, you're going to bag South Australia." I said, "What?" I said, "No, I was asked to go along here, give a speech here, and talk about the state of the state and the state of the nation as I perceived it." And what it all goes back to, I'll get this out of the way right from the beginning, was that I wrote an article for the Inside Melbourne magazine about Adelaide. I must admit, Michelle, when she read it, said, "Why'd you write that?" Because I was coming back here. And what I said, I raved about the town, I raved about the gardens, I raved about the sports grounds, I said how wonderful East Rundle Street was better than Lygon Street, I said that Shiraz in here and Annie's Lane wine is better than you'll find in Burgundy. I went on and on and on and on, but I did say one thing, and being in the press club it's important. I said, but Adelaide is the Bermuda Triangle of news. I don't like towns that have only one newspaper. Never did, and never will. And I think it's not knocking the tizer. I mean, in the advertiser, you've got the only broadsheet tabloid in Australia, when you think about it. But I think you need that. You need the competition. And as an ex-editor of the Sydney Sun, I loved it when Mark Day and I, as bearded bookends, went head to head. He Day on the Mirror, me on the Sun, and ferociously went at each other, and it made better journalism. I mean, I'm not saying you run all those bullshit posters that we banned when I was on the Sun. I kept one from the Mirror. It was, and I've still got it in my house, actually, to remind me how bad things got at times in tabloid journalism in Sydney. And the headline, the poster, street poster, said, "Model Rape Horror." And I sent a fax to Mark Day saying, "You really topped it this time. Model Rape Horror." There was no model, there was no rape, and there was no horror. What it was Margot Hemingway, since deceased, played a model who got raped in a movie. One of the great Jim Oram beat-ups of all time. The man whose main claim to fame was defecating in handbags at parties. But model rape horror was the thing. And I faxed Day and said, "You really hit the depths on this one." And he faxed me back stupidly saying, "Wait till tomorrow, Darren. Pope's son rapes queen." Which I thought was a pretty good riposte. Came in bloody handy. We were on Four Corners the next night. And I could read it out and say, "This is the quality of the Mirror. Pope's son rapes queen, hello." He then bailed me up in the men's toilet and had his hands around my throat saying, "Don't you make me wear the fucking black hat. You're just as bad as I am." That was what was happening in the days of television, of tabloid journalism in Sydney. One of the finest moments, I think, was Granville, the Granville disaster. I was editor on that day in Sydney. And I'd made a huge campaign and gone and done my own TV commercial before Ita and John Singleton used to write her lisp into her commercials, incidentally. I was the editor of the Sun when Granville happened. And I was right down on the stone. I got a call. It's 12 minutes past 8. I'll never forget it. And I got a call from a police rounds reporter. And he said, "There's been a train crash out at Granville." And his name was Murray Trembath. I'll just go back 25 years. His name was Murray Trembath. He was a cadet. And he phoned me up in a tremulous voice, said, "I think there's about 8 or 10 people dead. And a train crash." I said, "Geez, that's a good story." And my police rouser then phoned up, called Graham Davis, Wacker Davis. And Graham called up and said, no. He said, only two. And Trembath called me back. I'm right on the deadline. I'm sitting with a stone there, ready to send the page away to the stereo. And he called me. He said, "Darren, I've talked to a policeman. There are 80 people dead at Granville." And I thought, what do you do? Grave difference between putting a page one out with 80 people dead or 8 people dead, and you're in real trouble. So I did a hinge hunch, and I went with the 80. And the next edition, we went with 84. And by the third edition, there were 83, confirmed. I must admit, I said to my deputy editor, I said, "If they don't get one more, I'll shoot one." It was a tough environment. But I went on the word of a cadet journalist rather than my police reporter, and it was an awesome experience. We sold more newspapers that day than any other day in the Sun's history, except for one. One day when we got a story from... I did what every editor, and all you news guys know this in the room, I'm guilty of it too. I sent one of my mistakes overseas to get him out of the way. You give him an overseas posting, not as a reward, but to get him out of your hair. And I sent a guy who's now dead called Len Cozzi, who was news editor of The Sun when I was a cadet, who scared the bejesus out of you. He was so tough. So tough. He'd have you trembling as a young journalist when he just beckoned you into his goldfish bowl and tore you to shreds. He had one reporter vomiting in his news editor's room. He was so awesome in this. And I came back from New York as editor of The Sun. And a lot of resentment because everybody thought they'd all move up one, you see. Somebody get the job, they'd all move up one. Well, instead of that, they all moved back one because I came in from over top. And they all moved down one rather than up one, and they didn't like me. And the journalists there who had still sitting in the same bar they'd been at when I went away 12 years earlier. But Cozzi, by this stage, who was Neanderthal man, Len Cozzi was chief sub-editor of the Sydney Sun. And I'm trying to clean this paper up. I got rid of the page three birds. I said, we don't have bimbos on page three. No page three birds anymore. Get rid of that. Do this, do that. Clean up. No phony posters. None of that. And Cosy was there as chief sub-editor. And I sent him to London. Gave him a top prime job in London. And I paid for it. Because he filed a story from the London Daily Express that said Prince Charles is going to marry Princess Astrid of Switzerland or Sweden. I can't remember that. Marie Astrid. Her name was. And it said official. Charles to marry Marie Astrid. So we went with it like the clappers. Page one lead of the Sun. Big story, big pictures, the whole works. AAP put out a denial from the palace saying rubbish. Totally knocked it down. We didn't run the denial. We ran it about 12 pars in. But the Mirror splashed on page one the denial. We've got Princess Marie Astrid getting married to Charles on page one. They've got the denial on page one. And was selling like you couldn't believe. But I wanted to have an honest paper, so I called Cosy in London, and I called the editor of the Express. I said, hey, look, I've got a denial from the palace. Are you guys still running with this? They said, we stand by our sources. We stand by them. They're legit. And in fact, it was from inside Buck House that was what they actually got. They were trying to force Charles to marry Marie Astrid. I mean, you've seen what's happened with Princess Di since then. You understand what it's all about. And the manipulation that Buck House can get into with the spin doctors. And I called the editor and I said to him, are you still hanging on this story? Because I'm hanging out here. He said, yeah, we're not changing one word. I said, oh, okay, that's fantastic. He said, we've dropped official off it, though. So I called Cosy back and I said, what are they saying in the third edition? He said, well, Alex, what does it matter, Charles? What does it matter? He's going to get engaged and married to somebody. What are you worried about? So it came back to haunt me. I mentioned Princess Di, and the reason I mentioned her is that I used to be head of the Variety Club in Victoria, and I applaud you guys what you've done with the Variety Club here in South Australia. It's probably one of the hottest tents, the newest tents in the world, and I'm absolutely wrapped in what you're doing here with the Variety Club. But in my days as head of the Variety Club in Victoria, I devised that little hat, the top hat and the heart that you see around here, and Sue does it very well, and they put it all over the place. I drew that, believe it or not, on a beer coaster at the Flower Drum Restaurant in Melbourne. It's now the international symbol for variety, and I'm very, very, very proud of it. But I met Princess Di about four times in that capacity when she came up for the premiere of Burke and Wills, the movie. She once said she had a brain the size of a pea, and I think she was exaggerating. She really was a ditz, I tell you. I was at a government house function with Princess Di and Chuck. And those ears are huge, I tell you. But he does have some charisma in the flesh. But we had this function with Princess Di, and I was standing talking to Philip Adams. I think it was Philip who tried to fill the conversation void and said, what do you watch on the television, Mom? And she said, I kid you not, she said, I watch Dallas and Dynasty. She said, I like to see how the other half live. And I said, you are the other half. And it went straight through to the keeper. Did not have a clue. Now, I don't often get up and do public speaking. It's not something I really, really enjoy or really do. I figure I talk it up on radio and television to get away with it. But I remember when I first came back, thinking of the Sydney Sun, came back as editor. They brought me back as deputy editor. I offered to come back as editor-in-chief. And they said, no, you've got to be appointed from inside to be editor. I said, well, I'll come back. If I'm not editor in 6 months, then I'll piss off. And the editor went on holidays, so within 4 weeks I was editor. And that's the way it works in that business. But I came back, I was invited to go and give a speech to Mad Mary Fairfax's group, Lady Mary, Mother of Fairfax. And went out to give a speech to 200 Jewish women from the eastern suburbs in Double Bay. And I thought, okay, I've got to be really good here. I've just come back from America. Get it all together. Get it all. Think it through. Yeah, there's Ehrlichman. There was Haldeman. There's Watergate. I'd covered the Watergate hearings. John Mitchell went to jail. It was his wife who got stabbed in the bum with a needle when she started to blow the whistle on him. And then there was this one and that one and John Dean, and his wife's name was Mo. And I had it all in my head. I said, I'm ready to go. I get up to make the speech. Ready for the first question. And I looked around this room full of women. And the first question came up. And a woman said, Mr. Hinch, what's Paul Newman really like? So I can tell you, Paul Newman is much shorter than you think, and he's been wearing blue contact lenses for about 35 years. And Sylvester Stallone's about 4'9", And Sophia Loren at 60 is the most gorgeous woman. You'd crawl out of broken glass for her. And Helen Gurley Brown, who was just out here recently, the founder of Cosmopolitan magazine, wears rouge on her nipples. I don't know why, but she does. And she's proud to tell you about that. Or even show you. That's what Helen Gurley Brown, as the Cosmo girl, the single Cosmo girl, really did. John mentioned a roller coaster ride. It has been a roller coaster ride. I've been rich and I've been poor, and I prefer being rich. Liz Hayes said to me, the question when I lost so many millions, she said, how could you lose all that? I said, I don't know, I just did. I just lost it. And the houses in Hawaii and all those sorts of things. She said, but you can't lose all that money. I said, well, it's easy if you can, because I did. And she looked at me and she said, she looked around the room, when I was living in a, thanks to Mr. Kerry Packer, an $1,800 a week apartment in the penthouse of the Regent Hotel in Sydney, which wasn't rubbish. And she said, you realise you may never have this again? I said, yep. She said, how does it make you feel? I said, I had it. I had it. And that's the main thing. I've never felt down. I've always been an optimist. You do what you have to do in life in terms to working. I've been lucky enough, although I said to Bob Falkingham, you'd know Robert, the boss of Fairfax, who once said to me when he made me New York Bureau Chief, he said, you've been a lucky young man all your life, Mr. Hinch. And I said, no, in this business, you make your own luck. And I believe that to be true. You do make your own luck. And I was walking out of the room, Tom Farrell, the editorial director of Fairfax, said, oh, you're now the Bureau Chief in New York, Darren. I said, thank you. And they said, you're now the Bureau Chief in New York, Darren. I said, thank you. They looked at me as if it should be genuflecting. As I walked out the room, Farrell said, hey, Darren, you're 35, aren't you? And I said, yep. I figured if that's what they want me to be, I'm 35. If you want me to be 35, I'm 35. I was actually claiming to be 31. I was actually 26, claiming to be 31. I went over to my then wife, Lana Wells, a journalist, as some of you would know. She was women's editor of the Melbourne Herald and worked in New York for the Melbourne Herald. And I said, guess what? She said, what? I said, I just aged another 4 years this morning. Doesn't you know you're getting older, you know, when you start telling the real truth? I am 54. I was born in 1944, so it makes me 54, genuinely. But I figured if that's the stupid thing that executives want you to be, then I'll be it. You know, get the old Clorox out and put on your driver's license, change the date, and there you go. I am here under false pretenses in Adelaide, to a degree. I'm talking to the 5DN table down here. I'm adoring being in Adelaide. But I'm here under false pretenses because I'm here for only one reason. Her name is Michelle Baker, and she's sitting down here at this table. And I fell head over heels in love with her. And I was at Mount Macedon at my vineyard. And I thought, well, if Muhammad won't go to the mountain, gotta do it. And I arrived in Adelaide on the most amazing Thursday of my life. I'll never forget it. And Dave Allen, a program manager from 5DN, took me to lunch. I was filling in for Jeremy for 1 week. And I met up with Michelle again. Went to lunch at the Oxford. And the bosses, David and Wayne, said, we're thinking of changing 5DN. Do you want a job? And I know I'm not that stupid, but I figured they used Michelle as a carrot to catch the donkey. And they said, do you want to do breakfast on 5DN? I said, yep. And they said, do you want to walk next door? I said, why? Well, Channel 9 owns a brand new apartment. It's there, only there to park Mr. Lamb's Ferrari. You know that, don't you? That's where you bought the bloody place. And I said, walked in, and there it is, this furnished apartment, where they take your sheets away every Friday and iron them. Can you believe this? They are iron sheets. Who has iron sheets? But they do. And a nice S70 Volvo came along with it. I've driven it twice. Thank you, darling. And I thought, this being broke isn't so bad after all. And so I've come to Adelaide. I'm having a wonderful time. I've found Annie's Lane Shiraz, one of the great wines of the world. I, by coincidence, had, because I have a vineyard in Mount Macedon, I had moved my my vintage this year by coincidence in April, shipped it all to South Australia because I changed winemakers, and all my wine is at Norman's, being made into good Pinot Noir, Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc by one Andrew Garrett. And so life's pretty good. And when Liz Hayes, I mentioned it before, when Liz Hayes did the 60 Minutes interview, when I went down the gurgler big time, I blew about 14 million, which I've heard you say it fast, you know. She said, I'll talk to your friends and they were worried that you were going to commit suicide. You might kill yourself. I looked at Liz and I said, no way. I said, be a terrible waste of talent. Thank you very much. If you like, do you have any questions? Do you have anybody any questions? I'd rather talk about what you want to talk about. No, not at all. I won't read the answer.
I've recently been involved in efforts to stimulate investor interest from South Australian business in a TV drama series to be filmed in Victor Harbour, and Victor Harbour is the site unless money doesn't come through. It's slow going. My question is, in your opinion, if the state is serious about marketing itself, why is it so difficult to get tourism industry to invest in something that will market the state worldwide? Is the state of the state such that we blithely let opportunities pass us by?
I'd say no. I think that depends how good the script is. If the script is good, you get it up. I was working on a script which was going to be set in Adelaide. It's not. It's now going to be set in Wollongong. And if that movie script was good enough, I got great reaction from the South Australian people when I first floated it by here. I said Olsen grabbed this, you're going to bag the state. Your problem in South Australia is there's so much negativity. It's so bloody negative. You know? I mean, small businesses don't get a charge. You're so negative. It's like if one more person asks me how much I'm liking it, like lapdogs saying, do you like us? Do you like us? Do you like us? Who gives a shit if I like you or not? You know, get out there and do the job and get some sort of positive mood going. I mean, I know out in Unley Road where Michelle has her model agency, it's tough times. There are clothes shop after clothes shop after clothes shop. But get out there and get governments out of your hair. I had the Lord Mayor on the program a few weeks ago and I was filling in for Jeremy once again. And I said, get out of my life. Get out of my life. You know, if I want to shop at 3 o'clock in the morning, if I want to buy something at 3 o'clock in the morning and you want to sell me something at 3 o'clock in the morning, then let's do it. Get the government says, you can't. You can't. It's watching what I saw happening in Victoria, and thank Christ in the end they changed it and got on with their lives and loosened things up. But I recall a time back in a few years ago when I was on 3AW and a guy called Frank Pinhalurak owned a hardware store in Hawthorne. And the police kept arresting him every Sunday. Because you're trying to sell hardware on the only other week when you want to buy hardware. I mean, when do you want to go to a hardware shop? On a Sunday. When do you want to go and buy a sofa with your wife or your husband? On a Saturday or Saturday night, whatever. And they kept arresting him, and I made a big joke about them arresting all these electric drills. And they fined him $500,000 and put him in jail where he had a heart attack. And all his biggest crime was he wanted to open his hardware store. Gotcha. Wanted to open his hardware store on a Sunday. And it was the same time they just legalised brothels in Melbourne. I went out and said, this is Noddy Land. I mean, you get a screw on a Sunday, you can't get a screwdriver. and the same thing's happening here, you know. In California, sure they've got a bigger market, sure they have there. But if in business, in private enterprise, if you want to go shopping and buy your groceries at 3 o'clock in the morning, fine. And if you don't want to, and I'm opening my shop at 3 o'clock in the morning, you won't buy it and it'll close down. It's called market forces. And I find that's the sort of stuff I find really, really bizarre. And I find the negativity here at times. I mean, you've got a great state, you've got a great city. It's a pretty city. The Burgundy can't touch the wines of the Clare Valley. No way known. You've got all that stuff going for you. So, okay, you lost the Grand Prix because you fucked it up. That's why you lost the Grand Prix. Because they thought they'd never lose it. They thought that... Hello? You thought you'd never lose it, you know. Just get out there and go for it, you know. I know the argument. The one heckler I get is my lady. How's this going on, huh? you've got the Barossa, you've got this new Bluebird train going up. You've got all these sorts of things. It's just fantastic sort of stuff. If only governments would loosen up and let you go. And I just find I do find the parochialism a bit of a worry. I do find the fact that in most cities, you have 6 degrees of separation. Here, about 2 degrees of separation. Okay, at 2 o'clock this morning, I was dancing with two blondes at a nightclub at the Hyatt at the footy show party. That was at 2 o'clock. At 7:45, I got a phone call from Michelle saying, at 2 o'clock, you were dancing with two blondes at the Hyatt. I said, and a redhead. I said, I forgot the redhead. So, but it is, everybody knows everybody. But that should work to your advantage in a funny way. You should be able to network and make it work to your advantage. But as we were going, your question about the film script, if it's good enough, it'll get up. Because I find the people in the South Australian Film Corporation have been very, very enthusiastic and very, very encouraging. Okay. Another question?
Darren Rex Jury, Adelaide Advertiser, tabloid broadcast.
You still wearing your RM Williams?
Absolutely. Not today. But not today. Not today. I'm a mate of Mark Day's too. Darren, if you were Premier for a day and you could make one decision to kick South Australia along, what would you do?
Sell your electricity company. That's what I'd do. I'd sell it. I don't know what this is all about. You're crazy. I'll tell you what's going to happen with the power companies here. What's going to happen with ETSA is that with all the deregulation, I've watched it. I mean, it's a political thing. Bull dust. I mean, you've got a Liberal Premier in Victoria. You've got a Labor Premier in New South Wales. All want to sell their power companies. They have done it, privatised it. Carr's trying to. The Labor Party's trying to stop him. If you don't sell ETSA now, you'll get tiddly squat for it in 4 years' time when you have to sell it, when they deregulate. I think it's mad. I think it's madness. Get rid of it. Now, I know going into that argument, it's the fact that they privatised the water supply in Sydney, sort of. Yes, and that was a biggie. And they privatised electricity in Auckland, and that was a biggie. But in the end, governments have no rights being in airlines. And I'm a great believer in decentralisation. What I'd like to see is, if I was Premier for a day, maybe Prime Minister for a day, I would, if I could constitutionally do it, I would scrap all state governments. All state governments. You're overgoverned to death. Right? You get rid of them all. You have only 18 million people. They've got 60 million people in Britain. They only have one government. I get rid of all state governments, turn them into art galleries Jeff would turn them into a poker machine palace, but turn them into movie theatres and art galleries. Get rid of the state governments. But beef up your local councils. Make your local councils tougher so they are strong and they do such things like they collect your garbage and they keep your streets clean, all that sort of stuff. The really basic nitty gritty stuff, you do that. But you're all, who needs? In Victoria, the upper house in Victoria sits for about 20 days a year. There's one idiot there called Ian Cover, who's a mate of mine. He laughs. He gets $80,000 a year. And he sits in the upper house he's one of the could have been champions. He's a champion, all right? He's got 80 grand a year to sit for 30 days a year in Parliament. You know, House of Review. They don't have one. They don't have state governments in Britain. They don't have an upper house in Queensland. They don't have an upper house in New Zealand. I won't get started on politics because I find it obscene. I've never voted in my life. I've never voted in my life because, A, for two reasons. One, I think it's undemocratic for voting to be compulsory. I really do. And I think journalists either should not vote, or if they do, tell us how they vote. I want to know how George Negus votes. I want to know how Laurie Oakes votes. Well, I know how Laurie Oakes votes. I think I could interview. I didn't vote because I'd go and interview Andrew Peacock, was my best man. I never voted for him. I could interview Peacock or Hawke on the Monday after an election, and they know I didn't vote for them. I didn't vote against them. And I think if journalists put their hands up and said, this is how I am, either abstain while you're a journalist or declare where you are at, I think that's the way it should be. But, compulsory voting. It's not compulsory in Britain. It's not compulsory in the United States. It's not compulsory in New Zealand. It's not compulsory in Canada. Why are we the only ones in step? How come we are treated like children? Say, oh, if we don't make you vote, you won't. Well, if you don't vote, you've already voted, haven't you? Right? Anyway, I'm getting the wind up. I'm very good at this. For the reason I said, as a journalist, I don't think I should. I think I should be above it, and I think I should be above it. And so, you know, I'm not pushing a cause. I'm just saying what my opinions are. I'm not voting for them, not voting against them. Robert?
Maybe they're paying for it. Robert Mayne from the Bulletin, and I'm not going to vote for Pauline Hanson this next federal election. My former Fairfax colleague, are you familiar with the famous story of Dave Pick?
Yes.
You've got to tell him.
The famous story of David Pick. David Pick was a... Jesus, going back. Robert and I worked together on the Sydney Sun in 1963, 35 years ago. He wears his hair a bit further back in his head now than I do, but that's the only difference. David Pick was a reporter for the Australian Associated Press. And he went out and did a story about a guy who just had his life saved. I think I'm getting this right. Just had his life saved when he fell under a tram. And the opposition got the story. And the officer got the story and said, miraculous recovery, man saved on his birthday. David Pick didn't have the fact that it was a guy's birthday. He missed that. His editor ripped him up to pieces so many times, took him up one side of Broadway, down the other side. And forever after, he became a legend. Every story David Pick ever went on, whether it be a murder, a rape, a car crash, or a weather story, he would always say, "Is it your birthday?" Is that the one, Robert? So he became known as David, "Is it your birthday, Pick?" And he's gone down in legend in the Sydney newspapers.
Darren Fewings, 5DN. You mentioned a couple of characters from journalism, Mark Day. And when I was a copy boy at the News, Mark Day and Kerry Sullivan were both working on a publication called The Adelaide Truth. And it's amazing what a great training ground it was. I want to ask you, who are the great journalists in Australian history?
Pooh-wee. It was me. a New Zealander who sort of swings into the Australian bit, Peter Arnett, despite his latest problems with the sarin gases. I say Peter Arnett's probably one of the great reporters of all time. He was the man who, in my mind, I know television ended the Vietnam War in my mind, because the images of suddenly seeing people burning and dying. But Peter Arnett wrote this story, interviewed a colonel in Vietnam, and quoted him as saying, the American colonel, "We had to destroy the town in order to save it. We had to destroy the town in order to save it." And I thought, what hypocrisy, what's going on here? This is madness. And I recall my early days, I tried to go to Vietnam, and I was working with United Press International at the time as bureau chief in Toronto, Tronna, and I couldn't get there. I wanted to go. And it's one great regret, A, that I didn't become a war correspondent, or I did cover a lot of riots, but B, I didn't get to Vietnam. But I remember the hypocrisy in newspaper offices. Most editors, hawkish, most owners, very hawkish about Vietnam. And I recall we had this passionate discussion in a newspaper office about airbrushing the pubic hairs on that 12-year-old girl who'd been napalmed running down a highway in Vietnam, when the ultimate obscenity of being all these people being murdered, they didn't care about. And they went through great things. Should we run this picture of this 12-year-old girl? And if we do, we must get the airbrush out and get the photographers to paint out her pubic hairs. And I said, this is naughty, this is crazy. And that's what happened. So they'd be one of them. Our cartoonists are obviously the best in the world. Pat Oliphant would be one of the great, Pulitzer Prize winner, great Australian cartoonist. For knockabout journalism, for real knockabout tabloid journalism, it would be hard to beat Pat Burgess, who was a Sydney Sun, I would say. Good journo. Ray Kerrison went to the New York Post. Good journo. Peter Michelmore, good journo. Jack Darmody. Oh, God. Well, let's put him in another category. You can have a separate category for Darmody, right? Yeah. And one thing about Darmody was, as a tabloid journo, he was like a Rottweiler. He was a very good Rottweiler, Darmody. But he had hands, one of his hands was the size of both of mine, and he used them a lot as well, you know. That's all gone, though, that sort of journalism. Maybe we romanticised too much about it. I mean, in fact, we all drank too much, we drank too much beer, and we did all that sort of stuff. It's all sort of changed now. I mean, the Sydney Morning Herald has now has computer terminals in that beautiful building in Darling Harbour, overlooking the harbour, and they all go and drink mineral water and go home at night. Nobody goes to the pub or the press club, you know. And the press club in Sydney closed for 4 hours a year. 4 hours a year, 4 a.m. on, I think, Christmas Day, and 4 a.m. on Good Friday. And I'm given the wine by a beautiful young lady down here, so I'm going to go and sit down now. And I thank you for your time. Thank you for your attention. I really enjoyed it. Thanks very much.
A few occasions where Darren has finished ahead of time and hasn't gone right down to the wire.
I got a wine from down here.
On your behalf, I'd like to thank Darren for his recollections today, and certainly some of the names he mentioned brought back some memories for some of the more senior journalists here today. Darren, thank you very much for your reflections today. I'm sure we all hope that journalism will go from strength to strength, despite all the changes that we see happening around us. And I think whatever we think of Darren when he voices some of his opinions, we can't it can't detract from the fact that Darren is someone who is firmly committed to journalism and good journalism. And I'm sure journalism through the last 20 to 30 years in Australia has benefited from Darren being involved in it.
Thanks, mate.
So, Darren, thanks very much for your words today. And may, on behalf of the club, I'd like to present you with a bottle of Lindeman's Limestone Ridge.
Very nice. Thank you very much. Thanks very much. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you.